Welcome back. Last time out, I asked you if you liked your name and initials, and most people do, but not those people that are given really bad names. And as the research has shown, sometimes you like the initials enough to influence other important behaviors, like Jack is indeed more likely to move to Jacksonville and marry Jackie than Philip, who is more likely to move to Philadelphia and marry Phyllis. Scientists call this phenomenon, the name letter effect, and say that it is influential enough to encourage the pursuit of name resembling life outcomes and partners. However, if you like your name too much, you can be in trouble. Leif Nelson at the University of California at San Diego found that liking your own name sabotages success for people whose initials match negative performance labels. In another study, Nelson and Simmons investigated the name of, the effect of the name resemblance on batters' strikeouts. For example, in baseball, strikeouts are recorded using the letter K, back to K again. After analyzing Major League Baseball players' performance spanning 93 years, researchers found out that batters whose names began with K struck out at a higher rate than all the other batters. And in a second study, Nelson and Simmons investigated the phenomenon in school. Students whose name begin with C or D earned lower GPAs than students whose name began with A or B. So, how else do names influence behavior? Well, the first letter of your childhood surname determines much about your consumer behavior as an adult. Why are some people more likely than others to wait in line overnight? Remember what I told you, the tendency to act quickly, to acquire items like that brand new iPad or whatever, comes from the people that have letters that are found at the latter part of the alphabet. And those people are faster to move. And the effect occurred only with childhood surnames, not names that had changed due to marriage. So children with last names that fall late in the alphabet are often at the end of the line or at the back of the class, and the idea holds that children develop time-dependent responses based on the treatment that they get, according to who? By the way, Carlson and Conrad. Another coincidence, I'm sure. In an effort to account for these equities, children late in the alphabet will move quickly when name isn't the factor they buy early. Likewise, those with last names early in the alphabet will become accustomed to being first, that individual opportunities to make a purchase won't matter very much. They will buy late. The last name effect is especially important to retailers and salespeople because customers' names are easy for marketers to obtain, and because there are many decisions in which the decision is not whether to buy, but when to buy, according to Carlson and Conrad. As much as your name and your initials are part of your identity, your signature, boy, do you want to write this down, is really, really important. Your signature means a great deal to you because you are warranting something almost every single time you sign your name. What does signing your name mean in the selling process? Or an influence? Well, for years, salespeople have tried to get a customer to sign a document, any document, from an ordinary deck of documents, to unconsciously sway the person to purchase whatever they're selling. Makes sense, right? Does this work? Does the customer's identity really get wrapped up in the signature? And how could that be? The research has been done, and this is the answer. By signing your name on the dotted line, that heightens your sense of self and leads to purchase behavior that affirms your self-identity. But signing can reduce engagement in consumers who don't identify strongly with a product or a category of products. So although there's a number of ways in which people may present their identity to others, signing one's name has a distinct legal, social, an economic set of implications around it. The act of signing has implications in the marketplace as well. In one experiment, consumers were asked either to sign or print their name in what would would appear to have been an unrelated task, which is important, before visiting a sporting goods store to purchase a pair of running shoes. Now, for consumers who closely associate their identity with running compared to printing their name, providing their signature before entering the store caused an increase in the number of running shoes they tried on and in the amount of time they spent in the store. Signing their name had the opposite effect on people who did not identify with running. They spent less time in the store and tried on fewer shoes. In yet another study, consumers were asked to make a series of product choices after signing or printing their names. Consumers who signed were more likely to choose an option that was popular with a social group they belonged to. The tendency was stronger when consumers chose in a product category that signaled their identity to others, like a jacket, than when they selected in a category that does not signal their identity, like toothpaste. And the study has implications for retailers and consumers, the authors told us. For instance, a retailer might ask shoppers to sign their name after completing a survey, enter a prize drawing, enroll in a loyalty program, since it's likely to lead consumers who identify closely with the store's products to become more engaged. But such signature interventions should be cautiously used, as signing tends to reduce engagement in consumers who lack such identification. So, although a signature does not necessarily imply commitment, it does always represent one's identity, because consumers sign or can be asked to do so in many consumption contexts. It's really important to develop a deeper understanding of how producing one signature influences behavior in your specific area. The Kardashian identity is not much different than my identity or yours. Understanding the power of your customers' and clients' identities now causes you to intentionally take that into consideration each and every time you communicate with them on an individual level. Now, that's the identification elements. Let's now look at something that's one of the neatest strategies that brings people to say yes. Let's call this the foot in the door. You can't persuade someone if you can't get in front of them to communicate your message. For hundreds and thousands of years of business, merchants, therapists, salespeople have all used the foot in the door technique to gain access to the person who can say yes. Question is, does it really work as well as salespeople think? You already know that every persuasion and influence strategy that works in selling, works in therapy, works in marketing, and so on. So we tend to say yes or no based on the interaction of certain measurable variables. I favor any strategy in the field of influence that's tested and proven to be effective. I want to share two powerful techniques that increase your chances of getting the result you want. The foot in the door technique is the first. The amendment technique is the second. FITD, sounds like a florist delivery service, is a simple concept. The idea is to get your client or your customer to say yes to a simple and small request immediately before you ask for a big yes. Remember the old days when an encyclopedia salesman would come up to the door offering a free 3-book set of a thesaurus dictionary and a grammar book, if you simply listen to his presentation about his encyclopedias? I do. I still have the Britannicas in the office. This is the perfect example of the FITD technique. You can ask your client customer to say yes to a small request so that you can have an opportunity to ask your customer to say yes to a large request. You cannot persuade someone if you can't get in front of them to communicate your message. More than we know, right? The foot in the door strategies are those strategies that have sold billions of dollars of time sharing. For example, one of the worst investments you can make, though it could be fun. How? Most resorts will ask you to give them 90 minutes of your time in exchange for free television tickets to Disney World, shows in Vegas, or a free weekend at the resort. The 90 minutes they want is a structured, high-pressure presentation designed for the person who is predetermined that there's no way that we will buy. The strategy has been effective for decades. pharmaceuticals are getting their foot in the door in a positively brilliant fashion nowadays. So instead of having doctors give away free samples, many pharmaceutical companies are having the doctor give the patient a free prescription coupon redeemable at the pharmacy, and all the doctor has to do is write the script. The pharmaceutical wins big because not only is the script written, but when the prescription is used up, all that needs to be done is call the pharmacy for a refill. Absolute brilliance that didn't always work when the MD was giving away free samples to the patient. More recently, researchers performed a meta-analysis of FITD data, and it's best summed up in one experiment. Researchers turned out participants to go door-to-door asking homeowners to place a really big sign in their front yard, and it said, "Drive carefully." It was big and ugly, according to the researchers, and 17% of the people they asked said they would go ahead and put this sign in their front yard. A second group of participants asked a homeowner to place a 3-inch little note card in their home. The message was, "Drive carefully." 2 weeks later, after they had had the 3-inch card in their home for 2 weeks, the participants returned with the big and ugly sign to each homeowner who agreed to put the 3-inch sign in their home, the 3-inch sign in their home, right? Now, 76% agreed to place the big, ugly sign in their yard versus the 17% who did it the first time. Now, all of that sounds amazing. Does the research tell us anything else? Research shows that using FITD can increase compliance in many situations by over 200%. Here's a few things that have been discovered. The larger the first request that is agreed to, the larger the first request, the more likely the person or company will say yes to the second and more important request. Okay? The larger. So in other words, had the same exact number of people that chose that agreed to put the 3-inch business card size sign in their house, had they agreed to put a 10-inch business card, you know, or a 10-inch card in their house, they would have been even more likely to help with the big ugly sign in the yard. So, and by the way, just a side note, this was true with one company I consulted with that used coupons to discover which coupons would draw more and what the retention rate of each coupon was. And the discovery was that the higher the price paid on the first coupon, the higher the price paid, the larger the retention rate. The lower price, i.e. greater discount, on the coupon had a much higher usage rate, but a much lower retention rate. I would say that's one of the most important things that I can ever share with you. Okay? Do not use money to induce compliance to the first request. When that is done, foot in the door does not work. In other words, don't offer someone money as an inducement to do business with you or to buy your product or service. And then the next thing you want to record is the receiver of the foot in the door must actually do something, not say they will do something for the foot in their door to be effective. In other words, they have to actually put that little 3-inch sign up in their house. Probably the window in the front window is what they're usually looking for and something like that. They actually have to do something, not say they will. So always remember, what people say and think they will do bears little relationship to their actual actions. It's not that people are ill-willed or have had bad intentions. People are just lousy predictors of their actions. People don't know themselves like they think they do, and we'll talk about that later on. In fact, simply go with this. What people say they're going to do is pretty meaningless. Observe what people have done in the past, and you can predict what they'll do in the future with greater accuracy than by asking what they intend to do in the future. Final key in this little piece here, if the request that you're making has some pro-social aspects, people are often more significantly likely to comply than they would in situations that are clearly for profit only. So the FITD technique is one of the most powerful persuasion techniques there are, and reams of research studies in the literature that prove this beyond a shadow of a doubt. It's just time to start doing it correctly in the way that it's actually been tested to work. Most people blow it. Now, the question is how can you apply FITD to your specific persuasion scenarios? You got to write those ideas down now while you're thinking of them. What people say and what they think bears little relation to what they actually do. Okay. So, frames. Cool strategy. Another cool set of strategies. There's a whole bunch of ways to be more persuasive with framing, but here's four that I thought I would give you. The first is get something of yours, like your product, your idea, your service, that has value into your customers' hands or minds. As soon as someone possesses something, they perceive it to be more valuable than they did immediately prior to owning it. Research by Kahneman and Tversky back in 1984 brings some examples to attention. Individuals who ultimately bet on Team A in a football game are often ambivalent about which team to select until they actually place their bets on Team A. Once they have placed their bets, they tend to dramatically favor Team A and show little hesitation in sharing their certainty that Team A is going to win. Another example from KNT, students receive mugs in research setting and are given the opportunity to sell the mugs. Other students are given the opportunity to buy the mugs. Students will not take less than $7.12 on average for the mugs they've taken possession of. The other students will not pay more than $3.12 for the exact same mug. Lesson: once you own something, you value it more highly than those who don't own it, even if it's owned for only 10 minutes. That is neat. The second cool way to frame, and right, you see that, right? I mean, all you have to do is get people to perceive that they own it in their mind, just like the bet on the football game, right? The second frame that you can use is to create a frame, like a word picture in your customer's mind, that your product, your service, your idea is something that they already possess, so that it becomes the status quo in their thinking. For example, our lawn service, well, let's say it like this. Once our lawn service is yours, we help you eliminate all the crabgrass that the old services you used were never able to control. And boy, can we associate with that, right? A couple of examples in this frame concept. Students in one class were given a decorated mug as compensation for filling out a questionnaire. Another class, students received a large bar of Swiss chocolate. When given the opportunity to trade with members of the other class, only 10% of students traded their item, while 90% stayed with what they had. Amazing. Another frame in this concept. More impressive, 45 students received a gift package of a Stanford calendar and a free dinner at a MacArthur Park restaurant. In another group, 45 students received a Stanford calendar and a certificate for an 8x10 professional portrait. Later that day, all the subjects were told they could trade their current package for either two free dinners at MacArthur Park restaurant or a professional portrait sitting including an 8x10, two 5x7s, and a wallet photo. The results were 81% of the dinner calendar group swapped their package for the two dinners. The lesson: people want what they have and more of it. The third really cool tested frame here is to create a word picture that creates a moderate amount of tension if the client doesn't do business with your company. In other words, what will the clients lose if they do not do business with you? So, example, one experiment with gambling. Individuals were given the opportunity to flip a coin, bet $10. Most were willing to gamble only with a payoff of $25 and a possible loss on the individual's part of $10. That's a 2.5 to 1 ratio. People are terrified of risk, right? Second, Research on real-life applications, loss aversion is much more pronounced for personal safety than it is for money. People will do more to protect themselves than for their money, although they do a lot to protect their money, but they'll do a lot more to protect their life. Loss aversion is more pronounced for income than leisure. People do care about their leisure, but they'll do more to protect their money than they will, say, traveling. Losing a chance to travel is not as powerful as losing income. The lesson, of course, is that people move away from loss. Determine what people lose if they don't do business with you or buy you, and artfully develop word pictures that clarify the hurt they might experience. For example, you're 7 times more likely to become disabled than die in any given year. And if you become permanently disabled, your family will lose everything because you will be unable to work and they will have the added expense of taking care of you. If you carry insurance against this enormous risk, you avoid losing everything and have the ability to maintain a high standard of living no matter what happens to you. Cool? And finally, fourth, don't confuse opportunity cost with out-of-pocket expenses. Your customer doesn't and is watching to see how you promote your business. So I'll give you a few examples of some research that were done in 2 cities by telephone sample, okay? The first scenario is this. A shortage has developed for a certain popular make of automobile, and customers must now wait 2 months for delivery. The dealer has been selling the cars at list price. Now the dealer prices the cars at $200 over list. Is that acceptable or is it unfair? 71% say that's unfair. In the second scenario, a shortage has developed for a popular make of automobile. The customers must now wait 2 months for delivery. Same thing, right? The dealer has been selling the cars at $200 below list. Now the dealer sells the model at list price. Is that acceptable or unfair? In this case, 58% say it's acceptable. Obviously, nothing has really changed in life, but because of the frame, it's different, okay? Scenario 3. Different setting now. A company's making a small profit. It's located in a city experiencing a recession with substantial unemployment but no inflation. The company decides to decrease wages and salaries this year by 7%. Is that acceptable or unfair? 63% say it is unfair. Meanwhile, in scenario 4, a company is making a small profit. It's located in a city experiencing a recession with substantial unemployment and inflation of 12%. The company decides to increase salaries by only 5% this year. Is that acceptable or unfair? In this case, the exact same situation as we just discussed in 3, 78% say it is acceptable. Each pair of scenarios presents 2 identical situations. In scenario 1 and 2, both involve a price increase of $200. Scenarios 3 and 4, both involve wages 7% below the inflation rate. However, the consumer reacts very differently to each option. Consumers do not want to perceive money coming out of what? Their pockets. So be certain to frame every promotion in such a way that the consumer is clearly saving, and assume that there is no mathematical ability on the part of any consumer that you deal with, okay? Framing is amazing. Mind reading. I want to go to mind reading. How to know what they're thinking. And this I won't be able to finish up on this audio file because there's just too much, but we'll start it here. I want to reveal to you a few of the most closely held secret approaches or tools that I use in determining what people are thinking about in any given moment. And you're going to learn probably my favorite model for determining current thought. And I'm going to give you one of my favorite models for utilizing that specific information and gaining compliance. Now, maybe it's just me, but I like to know what other people are thinking. I don't want to guess. I want to know. And when you can know, you can determine how best to help that person get what they want in business and in life. Instead of being involved in a long, drawn-out process, you can get rapid outcomes that are favorable to every single person involved. Ultimately, that's what you and I want. Most people experience massive idiopathic fear when it comes to communication in almost any context. In other words, they feel uncomfortable putting their feelings and thoughts on the table for fear that they'll be hurt in some way. When people cloak their thoughts and feelings, it makes communication difficult. Honesty becomes compromised, and everybody gets crummy outcomes, and you see this every day in life. Now, when people don't tell you what they're thinking or feeling, you simply need to discover, calculate, or discover those thoughts in different ways. You can use body language, psychographics, evolutionary psychology, psychobiology, cultural beliefs, religious beliefs, peer pressure, context, psychological profiling, expectancies along with prior behavior to determine almost anyone's current thoughts with some significant degree of accuracy. On large scales, you can read groups, cultures, specific demographics, and nations using the exact same tools. The more you know about someone or some group, the easier it is to gain compliance. It's just that simple. It's also true that in relationships, it's true in family, it's true in friendships, it's true in the selling context, it's true for all parts of business, it's true for the therapist, it's true for nations dealing with other nations. Intelligence in the military sense is what separates the wheat from the chaff in every single aspect of life. The ethical use of influence is never more necessary than when you have good intelligence about your client and customer. Knowledge is potential power, and that power can be just as easily used for good as it can for bad, obviously. The line is not always instantly clear, and sometimes the line changes. Without having great intelligence about your clients and consumers, you have little chance of being persuasive beyond luck. With good intelligence, you can achieve incredible results in gaining compliance, and if you think it's important in business, can you imagine how important it is in personal relationships? The fact is, the more you know about someone or some group, the easier it is to gain compliance. Now, before we go about utilizing intelligence, I want you to look at some ethical issues that arise in acquiring and utilizing intelligence. Influence hinges on good intelligence. And more than that, the ethical use of persuasion techniques can be compromised if you're not careful. Win-win or no deal is more than a slogan. It's important, really important, to build long-term relationships that are mutually beneficial. A lot of people know that one of my favorite all-time movies is Meet John Doe. And this movie was like 70 years ago. Gary Cooper, 1941, right at the beginning of World War II. Great show. The movie was released just as Nazism and fascism were spreading in Europe, and the war was underway, and it was in part a response to those who would find fascism an alternative in the United States. The movie was superb and did its job perfectly. A young newspaper reporter, Barbara Stanwyck, about to lose her job, concocts a story about a man who is so disgusted with the world that he's going to commit suicide on Christmas Eve. His fictitious note sent to the newspaper office is signed John Doe. The reporter keeps her job, but eventually has to find the would-be martyr who exists only in her mind. She interviews possible role players and ultimately convinces a homeless man, Gary Cooper, to be John Doe to the public. Further interviews and the press launch a John Doe movement across the country, based on principles of being a good neighbor, trust, helping other people, make the little guy feel important. Ultimately, John has to run for president. The unwilling but trapped John does indeed give the speech of a lifetime to a huge audience. Wondering how he can live with himself as a fraud, John seriously contemplates suicide, is saved only by a throng of John Doe fans. One woman's deception to save her job in wartime turns into a wonderful movement of enormous good. A homeless man's agreement to play the role of John Doe becomes a massive internal struggle between self and public fraud and the greater good of the country and the world. Now, this quick description doesn't even remotely do the movie justice. You gotta see it on Netflix or Amazon. It doesn't do justice to the ethical issues involved. It doesn't do the subject of persuasion and influence justice either. get it, rent it, download it, whatever, but watch every ethical and moral view that you hold be challenged. I would venture to guess that if you take advantage of the information I'm about to show you right now, you will nearly double your responses for your sales, adding clients and making successful influence attempts. Notice I didn't say increase by 10%. I said double. Here is who John Doe is in the 21st century. You're selling your ideas, products, and services and yourself to John every day, so you might as well meet him and his very, very good friend, Jane Doe, and we'll do that on the next file.